from Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Hello from Washington. I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Toddcast. We are a month and a half away from Joe Biden's inauguration, and we're starting to get a good look at how the new administration is viewing its team. This week, we learned that retired four-star General Lloyd Austin is the pick for defense secretary. This makes the third Democratic president in a row who has chosen a general or a Republican and not a Democrat for the top Pentagon job. Plus, we have new names for HHS, Housing and Urban Development, and the CDC, but we're still waiting on at least one big nomination, and that's for Attorney General. Joining me today, Annie Linsky, national political reporter for The Washington Post, and Alex Thompson, reporter for Politico and co-author of The Transition Playbook. Later in the show, Sarah Isker Flores joins me, senior writer at The Dispatch, to talk about how Americans are viewing the election and the polarized view of it. But first, let's start with Annie and Alex. Welcome to the Toddcast, and I want to start with the Pentagon situation, Annie, and the larger picture. I want to get into the specifics on Austin and Biden in a minute. But here we are, and it's a point of the third Democratic president in a row. Bill Clinton had Bill Cohen as his second-term Pentagon chief, a reform at the time, a Republican senator who was retiring. He picks him. Barack Obama keeps Gates, a Republican holdover, and at one point has Chuck Hagel, a former Republican senator. Here's Joe Biden now wanting to get a waiver for a general. Whether they realize it or not, I feel like these Democratic presidents are reinforcing this caricature of the Democratic Party that they can't lead the Pentagon.
Yeah, I mean, that is a great observation. It's one we've been talking a little bit about at the in the Post newsroom as well. One of the standout things about Biden's choice here, though, in my mind, is just his comfort level with this individual. He and Lloyd Austin, it's kind of fun. You can look through the Department of Defense's website and search on photographs of the two of them together, and you'll come up with quite a few kind of images. And they just do have a longstanding relationship. And to me, that seems to be like the big through line that we're seeing here. Yeah. with Biden and the choices that he's making, particularly in the really kind of critical cabinet slots.
So Alex, when I read the anecdote earlier today that said that Bo Biden and General Austin regularly attended mass together and prayed together, and had built a bond in addition to the bond that Annie pointed out, with just, you could just look at the photo library and see how often Biden was with Austin. There's no doubt in my mind why they couldn't talk President-elect Biden out of this if they indeed tried to, but they are creating an extra headache on Capitol Hill.
100%. This is actually going to be a mess. You know, the thing with General Austin is that he will now require a waiver, which means in addition to actually needing Senate confirmation, he actually now needs to get essentially legislation passed through the House as well. So the Congress is going to have two bites of the apple of confirming this guy. In addition, you know, a lot of Democrats went on the record in 2017 and said they didn't support giving a waiver to then General Mattis. And as a result, you know, a lot of them are going to have to change their minds. And you can bet the Republicans on Capitol Hill are going to point out that they're being hypocritical. And in some cases, some Democrats, including Rich Blumenthal and John Tester, have indicated that they're unlikely to vote for a waiver. And so this is going to be a huge mess. You know, at the very beginning, there was a lot of talk about how Biden was, you know, picking safe picks that were going to like breeze through confirmation. But now you have three in a row, really. You have Neera Tanden, you have Javier Becerra, and you have Lloyd Austin. And their confirmation battles are going to be a lot tougher than those first few picks.
You know, it's funny. I want to stick with Austin a minute here, Annie. You know, one of the things, one of the questions we've all had is when Donald Trump blew through norms, could you restore some of them back? And, you know, and there's been this debate, I have vacillated on it back and forth, that, you know, can you restore some of these norms, or are you going to have to legislate them back? And to me, this is proof. And granted, it's one example here with Lloyd Austin and the waiver. But here is one norm blown through by Trump, essentially, with Mattis. And we wondered, well, it's not going to get restored on its own, you know, and should we even have it in the law to try to create a norm that we also then will just go ahead and override it whenever we feel we want to. But to me, this is an early warning sign that if you think we're restoring some of these other norms, you don't understand human nature.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, you look at, if you think about President Trump knocking down these norms, and you know, what these norms do is provide guardrails for the presidency. That's what they are. And by knocking them down, you know, a person like Joe Biden can say, look, you know, of course my presidency is about restoring norms, but then you do get to pick and choose which ones you restore. And it's always easier to go through a life or a presidency without guardrails that somebody else has put up. Yeah. So Biden really is in this kind of enviable position right now of, you know, being able to say that he will restore some of these norms, but he does get to choose the ones that he doesn't want to follow. And I will say one thing, just sort of adding on what Alex said about the difficulty that this individual is going to have on the Hill. Not only does Austin have the waiver to worry about, but also his corporate record is going to cause consternation for Democrats. And in particular, his board seat on Raytheon, a company that sold weapons to Saudi Arabia for their war against Yemen, which many Democrats are very, very, very uncomfortable with. So you're just going to see a lot of different areas where there can be flashpoints on this particular nominee.
And Alex, what is the case that, I mean, to me, if you're going to ask Congress for this waiver, then you have to make the case that not a single other person that you can come up with is qualified to lead the Pentagon in this moment, that it had to be this person in this moment. Mattis, because of the unusual nature of Donald Trump, his behavior, it was easy to convince members of Congress, hey, man, you need somebody who's been around the block at the Pentagon. And if Trump's okay with this guy, let's take it, right? There was sort of that was almost unwritten, right? An unwritten case for why, yeah, you had to do the Mattis thing, right? It was for national security. That case is not here with Austin. And I would say Michelle Flournoy is just as qualified.
Yes, and I think this is one of the big problems why the Biden team is really scrambling to get its defense. Now, I think ideally they would have liked to have presented him as like the historic first. You know, he's the first black man to lead the Pentagon. But, you know, the news leaked out early. I'll say Politico reported it first. And as a result, you know, you saw this.
You're supposed to have a ding. I should have a ding, right? You know, anytime. Annie, you can do a post plug. I'll do NBC Peacock plugs. You know, we'll just do little dings. But anyway, go ahead, Al.
But as a result, you saw that they were not prepared for this rollout. The CBC members were completely, you know, they scrambled to get their statements out of support, but it took them almost 24 hours to really line it up. And as to your point, there were other people involved. And you also had Michelle Flournoy, who actually you could argue was more qualified and, you know, has more expertise on things like China. And also, you had a lot of women in the national security space feel that, yet again, a very well-qualified woman was passed over. And so you had another group of Democrats really sort of airing their grievances with this pick. It was not sort of a united Democratic front that the Biden camp was really hoping when introducing this controversial pick.
You know, and Annie, it's interesting. If Doug Jones is indeed Joe Biden's choice for attorney general, and right now it is pretty clear, personal relationship with Joe Biden and comfort, right? Tony Blinken, Lloyd Austin, Janet Yellen. And if it is Doug Jones, these are people who he knows well. He's spent time one-on-one with quite a bit. He's governed, essentially he's governed with in his mind, right? And those big four, I would assume a lot of women in particular are going to be disappointed that, okay, you broke a barrier, but I guess we thought there'd be more barriers broken.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, when you look at AG, I think that's right. This sort of sense that every group here, you know, women included, African Americans, you know, Asian Pacific Islanders, Hispanics, have been kind of quite vocal in this process in saying we want more representation. And, you know, Biden's response to that has been to say, you know, this is the job of these various groups. But I do think that, you know, throughout the campaign, Biden did a very good job of sort of being all things to all people and kind of winking and making each group believe that they really were special. And this is kind of like an early taste of what, you know, a Biden presidency is going to look like, which is when the rubber meets the road, not all these groups are going to be happy and they're not necessarily going to get what they were in their minds thinking they were promised. And you're certainly seeing this kind of discomfort. And, you know, if we're going to be digging.
Annie, I haven't even brought up the West Wing.
Yeah, look right. Exactly. The West Wing is
the two most the two nicest. I always say the two of the three nicest offices are Chief of Staff, the three nicest offices, Chief of Staff, Press Secretary, and National Security Advisor.
Yeah. Right.
They're basically the three offices with a fireplace.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yes. They're going to be very, you know, longtime aides to Biden. That have been with him forever, Klain and Sullivan.
Yeah, and white men as well.
Yeah, don't forget John Kerry, climate czar. I mean, we can keep going down the list.
Steve Ricchetti, you know, Tom Donilon. I mean, Mike Donilon, I should say. There is Biden does have these like two different instincts going. I mean, he wants people who are, he does genuinely love making historic firsts.
Yes.
I mean, you should see, you know, dealing with a press office with these various picks, there is this, you know, they love to list out the historic firsts. And sometimes, you know, you have to really dig in to see if that's actually accurate. But they do make a big deal over the firsts and lean very into them. But Biden still clearly, you know, he has been in Congress. He's been in Washington for, you know, four decades. And he has a set of people who he's comfortable with. And many of them are white men. And that is, so you have both things happening. I mean, you can't forget, of course, Biden did elevate the first female, first Black, first Indian American vice president of the United States, which is hugely important. But you do see these two kind of instincts kind of playing out in these picks that he's making.
You know,
AG, and it does all really, you know, come back in AG where he'll go there.
Because, you know, it's interesting you point, Annie, the thing that you mentioned about, hey, you know, Biden, let's not forget the history that he made with his running mate. You know, Alex, I remember Barack Obama used to use a line. There'd be complaints that he wasn't picking a diverse enough a cabinet and he didn't have a diverse enough White House staff. And when he picked Joe Biden, one of the lines he said is, I'm enough change. And, you know, but that was 2008. And I do think this is a different period. I think it's intriguing to me, Alex, that we are seeing where Joe Biden believes he has to placate certain constituency groups and where he doesn't, right? He is stuck to his guns on the Pentagon. He looks like he's going to stick to his guns on Attorney General and on State Department. But an uncomfortable weekend of complaints from Latino groups, and suddenly Javier Becerra for HHS.
That's 100% right. It is really striking to think about how different it is than 12 years ago when Obama came in. You know, and that was a case where, you know, yes, there was the first Black president, but, you know, Obama's cabinet, you know, he didn't seem to feel there was as much pressure to, you know, from the CBC, from the Hispanic caucus, from the Asian American caucus. I mean, the Biden campaign, to your point, has felt really on its heels with the Hispanic caucus. That's why you're seeing, you know, them sort of tout, Ron Klain told them, don't think of it as the big four cabinet posts. Think of it as the big six.
Yeah, well, you know what that meant? It meant, well, HHS is definitely going to a Latino now. Like, you had to, like, make good on that.
That's 100% right. And so it is really striking that, Joe Biden is really feeling the pressure here in a way. And I think it's very much sort of almost like this really weird musical chairs where you need, well, we need a black man here and a black woman here and a Latino here. Maybe we can get in a white guy here. And it's just been this very sort of striking dynamics.
Honestly, it's a little really uncomfortable seen. To watch, Alex.
Very much so.
You can sort of see. Yeah, they're not really hiding the placation very well.
No, it's sort of, in some ways you could almost argue it's like a bit cynical. And I mean, you sort of saw, some example of that with the Becerra announcement yesterday where Joe Biden announced him as Javier Barcarilla and then, Javier Becerra, and he couldn't even get his name right. You know,
it's a good thing he didn't do Xavier. He could have done
that, Exactly.
No, that was uncomfortable. And it feels like if this nomination doesn't go well, that moment will be played over and over again as sort of symbolic. Well, he couldn't pronounce his name. How sold was he on his nominee from the first place? You know, it gives off this air of, yeah, this was really last minute. He didn't even realize how to pronounce his name, even though it may have been a teleprompter issue or something.
Exactly.
So, Annie, we are speaking as if everything's hunky-dory with this transition and everything is going smoothly. And I'm of that mindset, which is I kind of think the shenanigans of the Trump campaign sort of belong in a shenanigans box, except it's very real in how many people take their shenanigans seriously. At the same time, the Biden folks are trying to do what we're trying to do, which is just look forward and don't get bogged down in the shenanigans.
Yeah, absolutely. And I almost think that the Trump shenanigans, to some extent, in this moment, are providing a favor of sorts to the Biden folks, because it makes it more difficult to focus on some of the kind of herky-jerkiness of these rollouts and of the kind of musical chairs that I think Alex sort of accurately described when we've been talking about these cabinet picks. You have sort of kind of intriguing discussions about these individuals that Biden is picking, and one day they're considered for HUD, and then the next day it's agriculture or vice versa. Or, you have a name that could go to Department of Defense or Attorney General. I mean, these are enormous jobs that you would think have quite different skill sets, and the Biden folks are looking at them as almost sort of interchangeable. And that is not getting the kind of searing attention that it might get in a more traditional transition, because as this is going on sort of page A7 of the newspapers, Donald Trump is doing these sort of highly unusual moves to try to cling to power, which is sort of rightfully taking more attention, but it is giving Biden a little bit of a shield.
That's an interesting take. I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're right. Alex, I think Annie's right that there is this, that in some ways Trump's stubbornness makes it harder for Republicans to make Neera Tanden a story, makes it harder to make Hey Baccarea, a story. It makes it harder to even make the Lloyd Austin thing a story, because if you're busy having to placate the president and say, oh yeah, maybe you'll be president still, then you can't take seriously the vetting of Biden's cabinet.
I think that's exactly right. It's very hard to attack Biden's incoming administration when you haven't said you believe there is going to be a Biden administration. And you are seeing some Republican groups, you know, the outside super PAC, or not super PAC, but, you know, opposition research group, America Rising, last week said enough's enough, where you need to actually start doing opposition research on these people, and have started, you know, FOIAing, you know, hundreds of different agencies for all these potential nominees. But I think Annie is exactly right that, you know, Trump has sort of managed to continue the media eclipse that has been the last 4 years. And, you know, Biden has, in some ways, it's still sort of a little bit of a continuation of the dynamic during the campaign, where Biden was able to sort of lay low and avoid some of the controversies, you know, avoid even campaigning to a degree, you know, as a result of that.
You know, and there's another thing that gives him a little bit of leeway in these picks too, Annie, and that is the closeness of the House and the Senate. In fact, I was starting to think Marsha Fudge was not going to get a job, not had anything to do with anything other than Nancy Pelosi can't afford to lose, even temporarily, too many more votes in the House.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is and that's giving Biden a wonderful, both in the House and, of course, even more so in the Senate. It is giving Biden a sort of very easy pass on not appointing people who, you know, were some of his opponents.
I know. But some of the I don't mean to interrupt you in your thought there, but, you know, some of the best ways to diversify leadership in America are sitting in the House of Representatives right now. Like some of the rising, and it is, on one hand, it's a reason why he can't appoint some of these folks, but I actually think it's really stunting the careers of some people. I think there are quite a few people in the House that would be running a couple of these cabinet agencies, but they can't afford it.
Well, you saw, you know, Javier Becerra is a fantastic example of that. I mean, here's an individual who was waiting around in the House for decades and thinking about wanting to rise to the speakership and realizing there just was no growth, you know, for a different reason, you know, left against the advice from many of his top advisors and now is coming back, you know, assuming he gets confirmed, to a fairly high profile job. But yeah, I think that, you know, I was talking to some members, some of the civil rights leaders who met with Biden yesterday, who were particularly disappointed with Fudge and the fact that she ended up in at HUD rather than.
Right. They're lucky she got a job.
Where he put another longtime friend, you know, speaking of the longtime friends, Tom Vilsack. And, you know, their sense is, why not elevate a new generation of leaders rather than kind of going back to, you know, a set who've already done the job and have already been there.
Well, I guess the Biden case, Alex, on for instance, on why a Tom Vilsack, you do have the governing, you know, which is, this does look like a cabinet for the most part, put together with a Republican Senate in mind.
Yeah, I mean, there's with Vilsack. I mean, that was true, especially with Tony Blinken, Janet Yellen, people that have already a record of being confirmed that could probably be easily confirmed again. I'll say that Neera Tanden did not seem to be a pick with a Republican Senate in mind. When you have the day that you announce the pick, you have the number two Republican in the Senate, John Cornyn, basically go out and say that her nomination is dead on arrival.
But by the way, that's OMB. No offense to OMB. I mean, as important of a job it is, it's actually weirdly low profile once they're in there.
100%. So you're absolutely right. I imagine that confirmation is certainly on the mind for all these top four positions. I think that's one of the appeals of Doug Jones at AG as well, is that this is a guy that almost certainly would sail through confirmation. And I think you're absolutely right that Vilsack is really in that same mold.
Annie, before we go, who's going to, how many disappointed, will any of these disappointed people in the Biden picks, become a thorn in Biden's side?
I think if they are wise Washington politicians, likely they will not. I mean, they will see perhaps an opportunity a little bit down the road. This is, you know, cabinets turnover. Another sort of dynamic here is this is a very old cabinet. Biden has chosen a lot of people who are in their late 60s and their early to, in some cases, like Yellen, late 70s, to hold these roles. And so there is a sense that there will be some amount of turnover. And it depends. I mean, I think that one of the bigger outstanding potential thorns is somebody we haven't talked about, Bernie Sanders, who right. really wants to be a labor secretary. And, you know, you already see him making some moves in opposition to, the Biden administration's agenda. Yeah. So he is somebody who's certainly showing what it would be like for him to be outside the tent, which is less.
No doubt he has a Republican governor issue. At the end of the day, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, or as maybe Ron Klain might say, we have a Republican asset in the Northeast. Just kidding. I'm kidding. Annie Linsky of The Washington Post, Alex Thompson of Politico. Thank you both for coming on. I appreciate it. I'm going to pause right there. We'll be right back after a quick break to talk with Sarah Isker. You're listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. My next guest is Sarah Isker Flores. She's a senior writer at The Dispatch. She's joining me to talk about the Republican reaction to the election. And I want to start by talking about the Knight Foundation's latest poll. Yes, it's a poll, but I'm careful about what polls we do these days, about Americans' attitudes around the 2020 results. And here are some of the top lines from the poll. 92% of Democrats think the Democratic process worked well. 89% of Republicans say it did not. 63% of Americans overall believe the media accurately called Biden the winner, but just 17% of Republicans agree with that. 59% of people overall say the media covered the election responsibly, including 92% of Democrats, but just 21% of Republicans believe that. 64% of U.S. adults say they were exposed to more misinformation in 2020 than in 2016. So in some ways, none of those numbers surprise me, Sarah. I don't think I'm going to guess that none of them surprise you either. But now that we're a month away from calling the election, those numbers now are disturbing.
Yes, that's an understatement. I mean, it goes to this thing that we've been talking about for 4+ years, where because media is now so much just what you want to consume that will confirm your priors, people are living in two different universes. And that's bad for both sides, by the way. I know that sometimes one side's like, yeah, but I'm living in the real universe and they're living in the fake universe. And like, nope, if you are only consuming news that you agree with all the time, I can assure you it is just as bad, and more so if you're that convinced that you're the one getting only the truthful stuff. And I think that the last 4 years has exposed, you know, people want to call it whataboutism, and there is certainly some eye rolling to be done about it and like which one's more serious and things like that. But at the same time, I think it's exposed that both sides have a real problem with their voters, with their leaders feeding into single narratives. And this is the result.
Who are the worst actors here? Like, I get angriest at those who I know the facts, but exploit the public's lack of confidence in those institutions. Those are the group of people I get angriest at. And they're some of them play politicians and some of them play journalists.
Yeah. It's sort of easier to name them. I think the grifter club, the people who believe that they are either personally or professionally going to profit from leaning into whatever the narrative of the day is. You know, there's that old French Revolution quote, where are they going? They're my people. I must lead them. Like, that's sort of the grifter club. And, you know, in the past, I think there's been grifters throughout time. I mean, Chuck, like DC attracts grifters of that variety.
Politics does. I mean, I've always, to do an aside here, you want to know the strangest people you'll meet? They're the campaign volunteers on any campaign. And I don't care if it's a liberal Democrat or a conservative Republican. The misfits of society always find a place in politics.
It is so true. But the problem now, and it's what you just highlighted, is that now where the narrative has gone, where the people, quote unquote, are going, is this undermining of the very institutions that keep the country together, that we all sort of share and agree on. When that is where the narrative goes, and therefore the grifters benefit from further undermining those institutions, that's where things get really bad and dangerous. And I agree with you, unforgivable.
So what is our job? And I say this like, so take a Ken Paxton.
Oh, goodness.
Okay.
He
looks to be pardon shopping, does he not?
That's funny. Yes. So now, of course, he would only be getting a federal pardon. But of course, we believe he's under federal investigation. So
correct.
How convenient.
Yes. So he comes up with a cockamamie. Well, he writes a press release that he claimed was a lawsuit. And somehow the Texas Attorney General wants, you know, wants relief from other states. Like, I'm trying to figure out the entire convoluted, like, what gives him standing.
And Chuck, it's worth noting that the Texas Solicitor General, Kyle Hawkins, really notably, like, screaming red sirens, did not sign the brief, which is highly, I mean, unusual is an understatement. And by the way, full disclosure to your listeners, I am married to the former Texas Solicitor General, who was Kyle's boss.
Right.
I just want to get that out of the way in case anyone's concerned. But that's a big deal and tells you exactly what this is, which, as you said, is a very fancy, long press release with some legal terminology.
Right. And so the point is, so here's a guy that it looks like a what it is, right? Some form of pardon shopping or something to get in the president's good graces. And the president gets involved and exploits it. And then the two Georgia senators. And I just, you know, you can't ever take this stuff back. Do they know that?
You know? What I think is so interesting, though, is that the president this morning basically disowned the previous Pennsylvania lawsuit brought by the Republican congressman that the Supreme Court rejected yesterday afternoon.
That's the one Ted Cruz was going to argue on.
That's
on
right.
Right.
Yeah. And the president kind of like new phone who dissed that lawsuit this morning and then puts all of his eggs in this lawsuit, the Texas lawsuit, which has actually far less of a chance. It is far less meritorious than the Pennsylvania lawsuit. And we're past Safe Harbor Day, and a happy Safe Harbor Day to you, Chuck.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed it.
It's so strange that Pearl Harbor Day is the 7th and Safe Harbor Day is the 8th. I think I'm a little uncomfortable with the double use of harbor for totally, totally different. Like, one is about honoring a catastrophe and one is about avoiding a catastrophe, I guess.
Yes, this year indeed.
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting because the Supreme Court will reject this Texas case. And, you know, I'm a legal nerd, Chuck, so forgive me. But, you know, Supreme Court original jurisdiction, I nerd out on this stuff. And so a state suing another state can skip the district court and the circuit court and go straight to the Supreme Court. But it's discretionary. And the Supreme Court rarely actually accepts their original jurisdiction. Normally, they'll just send you back down and you still have to go through all that process. That's why the initial thing that Paxton filed is actually permission to file this case. So this isn't going to happen. It's not going to happen on this process point. It's not going to happen certainly on the merits. They're not bringing any new claims. They're just, they packaged all of the claims from Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia into this lawsuit where Texas says those states injured Texas by not having fair elections and not counting their ballots correctly. But what happens then when the Supreme Court, including the Trump appointees on the court, unanimously reject this lawsuit as they just rejected the Pennsylvania one? And the president has said that all of the eggs are in this basket to his supporters. And same with those two Georgia senators. It's getting the tail is getting longer, you know, on the chance of anything happening or changing, including a single electoral vote.
But, we went through this. Now it's pretty clear, though, that the president is just trying to give his supporters something to donate $10 for.
I know, but he's running out of stuff. Like, that's the part. And I'm concerned what happens when they run out of fuel.
Well, you always try something more and more extreme. You always try something more and more desperate. What is the next level of desperate? He already tried calling legislators. He tried calling a governor. What's another level of desperate? I mean, I hate to speculate because he might try it. But, you know, I mean, you're right. We are running out of sort of any, you know, I'm waiting for him to declare himself president in exile.
And I mean, I'm laughing only because, like,
I know. I used to say it as a joke, too. And it's hard to laugh at anymore. But I do think politically, if you're thinking about running in 2024, then what Donald Trump is doing makes a lot of sense.
True, except this part of the problem of what he's done is undermine faith in our institution of elections, including in Georgia, where they have these two specials. If Republicans have the wind in their sails in these specials, Chuck, as you know, Purdue ran 88,000 votes ahead of Ossoff.
Yeah, I cannot picture the scenario where Democrats win both those seats. I can picture one. I can't picture both right now. I don't have that. It doesn't feel like that's there, except, boy, Republicans are trying really hard to blow this.
And if they do, Donald Trump will get blamed. Now, Donald Trump has since said that, no, it'll be Governor Kemp's fault if they lose those two seats. But no, it will clearly be Donald Trump's fault if they lose both of these seats. And then that really undermines, I think, him running in 2024 when he handed Biden, unitary control of the government under the Democrats. So I think that's a problem for his 2024 run. To your point about how likely it is that Republicans really can blow a close to 100,000 vote lead heading into this, I actually don't see a scenario really where they split. I mean, it's possible to win one and lose the other.
I do. I feel like my late father would have been a splitter. He was a big believer in not giving either party too much power.
I mean splitting you think he would have split? No, he'd have split his
vote. He'd have split his votes. Like it would have been he'd have had that mindset that the job is not only, he got the divided government we want, but at the same time, he would, there's no harm in one more Democratic senator if you want a Republican Senate. Right.
But then you have to coordinate which one you're going for. Do you think he would have voted for?
No, it's true. I mean, and I think that this is where the slight differences between each of the two could matter a lot. I mean, I think Loeffler made herself very unpopular with some. I could easily see Loeffler underperforming Purdue.
I think she is the weaker candidate, and I think Warnock, her Democratic opponent, is the stronger candidate.
I think so too. So that's why it's like, if you told me Warnock Purdue, it wouldn't shock me.
Yeah,
of course, which means it'll be Loeffler and Ossoff, and we both look like that.
You heard it here first. Yes. We know that we will look stupid in a little bit. But I think Republicans have maybe even helped Warnock by targeting him with most of the negative ads. Sure. It's upping his name ID. It's making him more famous. And in a special election, that's the ball game. This isn't a general where you're going to have a whole bunch of people showing up and then they look at the ballot and they're like, well, I don't know who that is. But yeah. No, the whole reason they're showing up in the first place is because they already know who it is and care and want to vote. It's special elections are basically general elections turned on their heads. Mm-hmm. This is a really, really different situation than November.
So then it really is Stacey Abrams versus Donald Trump, right? Who turns out, whose machine is more effective in a runoff?
And right now, the absentee ballots, as of this was just over a week ago, the absentee ballot requests are running in at 70% as they were at the same point pre-November 3rd.
Turnout's going to be pretty high. I know.
It's going to be really high.
It is, I guess, tell everybody that it decides control of the chamber and suddenly more people are interested. I mean, it shows you that the history of these runoffs, right? Democrats are 1 for 10 in these runoffs. And I think their win was like a PSC commissioner or something like that, like in the 90s. Like, and it's pretty obvious why, right? Like mainstream turnout, especially in the cities, just collapses in these runoffs. That to me, Warnock, I had a Brad Todd, who's a mutual, I think, source of ours. He had told me a long time ago his biggest fear with both was Warnock in a runoff, that it could hurt because it solves a turnout problem that the Democrats normally have.
And Georgia, I think, is really enjoying their new role as a swing state. They're just like taking it for a ride.
Yeah. I want to do a little transition to Virginia, but by asking, I've got some people who argue Georgia is going to be Virginia in 2030, right? Meaning by 2030, it'll be a light blue state a la Virginia. Virginia, you can't be too progressive, but if you're a mainstream Democrat, you're going to do okay in Virginia, right? Do you buy that's Georgia in 10 years?
I think I do, but I think you also have to remember that there's states that are going to go the other direction, like Minnesota.
Yeah.
And
you mean like, or how Iowa and Ohio are drifting, right?
Yeah.
They're on a drift right now. Oh, they look competitive. Sort of what Missouri looked like in 2010. Oh, look, exactly. It's still competitive. And then you're like, oh, no, it's not.
Not really.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have the problem along the southern border that Biden had, where Hispanic voters just turned out in enormous numbers for Donald Trump, and what that bellwether is for a state like New Mexico, for instance, the Texas western side with El Paso, and even Arizona. You know, Arizona went blue this time, but there were some concerning things in the data there on those counties with the highest Hispanic number of voters. And it's very different, by the way, than what happened in Miami. Also Hispanic, technically speaking, but a totally different set of people.
Miami's my hometown, and I say it's Hong Kong. Okay, and that's okay. You know, it's its own little entity. It will. What else shifts 40 points? Right. I mean, you know, if you think about it, like, you're not going to have that anywhere else in America. And by the way, you know, so it's sort of like you can plan for the rest of Florida normally, and then you have to figure out Miami-Dade all on its own. Let me ask you this.
I saw an interesting, on Georgia, an interesting stat that looked at the top 25 and bottom 25 states based on their STEM-ness, their like sort of leadership in STEM.
Yeah.
And all but four of the top 25 STEM states went for Biden, and all but four of the bottom 25 STEM states went for Trump. And of those four, they're drifting. And so Georgia is in the top 25. I think you see Atlanta turning into a very different city than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. Yeah. And if that trend continues, I think it will, per your point, in the next 10 years. Of course, it's going to look like Virginia.
Well, I remember in 2004, George W. Bush, of the 10 states with the highest education, that had the highest educated population, he only carried two in the top 10 in 2004, Colorado and Virginia.
And those are gone.
Those are now gone. I bring up Virginia, though. I saw that the Virginia Republicans have decided they do not want to succeed anymore in the gubernatorial race because they chose to pick their nominee by convention.
Yes.
I mean,
this is what they keep doing. But this is what we've seen also in California. Basically, states that start becoming under single party control, the opposition party, instead of becoming stronger, which in like a philosophical sense, I could argue why that would happen. But in practice, it never does. Instead, as they become sort of a shrinking minority, to your point about who shows up to volunteer, you know, kind of the weirdos show up.
Well, and we've seen this. It's funny. And I've pointed out this pattern. I brought up it happened in Colorado, where as Democrats started winning, they thought, we're not conservative enough. In Virginia, as Democrats started winning, we're not conservative enough. You're seeing it in Arizona. Oh, where Democrats are winning, you know, Ducey's not conservative enough, right? Like, this is it always is the wrong way to react. And you're then suddenly cede the independent vote to the Democrats in these states. That's what's happened. I mean, what's interesting to me about Virginia, for instance, is you can't be a progressive and win statewide. There's a reason Terry McAuliffe is actually going, Ralph Northam beat Tom Perriello in a primary, because you get a lot of moderates who know that and a lot of, frankly, right-leaning, you know, I think about my right-leaning neighbors here in Arlington County, who vote in the Democratic primary now so they can vote for a candidate they're comfortable with.
And see, that's exactly why those state parties turn the way they do. It's not that it's the same people at the state party as before, and they just think now they turn to the right. It's that, in fact, the people willing to join the state party change dramatically. And folks who are interested in running for office in, let's use Virginia. You know, 15 years ago, if you were a Republican in Virginia, you might be like, well, maybe I'll run for office. You know, it's a purple state. You never know. And now I have friends who are Republicans, who are the exact type of person who would run for office in Virginia, and are taking a pass, because what's the point? And what's the point of running, even if you could get the nomination in the general, because you'll lose. And because of that, then the type of people who run are of a certain like base, damn the torpedoes, and the type of people who then take over the state parties change in that same direction. I mean,
Barbara Comstock should have been the Republican nominee against Mark Warner in 2020, right? It was obvious. Or she should have run against Tim Kaine in 2018, right? But she never would have gotten the nomination.
Correct.
You know,
and I think her calculus was also, even if she did get the nomination, it would be
I don't know. I thought in 2018 she should have run statewide, simply because
I know
you can raise $20 million and lose a House race, or you can raise $30 million and you know, still probably lose the statewide race, but, you know, you
may. Virginia in a midterm does look really different than Virginia in these, 2021 mm-hmm. election, governor's elections.
No, that's for sure. So let me ask this question. I do have a theory that says that the canary in the coal mine on Trump's future is actually, and this is going to be totally dorky to say, the defense authorization vote.
That is dorky.
It is a little dorky. But the point is that he still has some power and he couldn't influence that. What's it going to be like for Donald Trump on July 1st when he tries to hold some Republican electeds and scare them and tries to keep them in line? I just don't think it's going to be there.
I think Republican electeds are so looking forward to January 21st when they can tune him out. That being said, I'm not sure they're making the right calculation, because these are the same folks who thought that there was no way that Donald Trump would get the nomination in 2016, and so they could ignore him. Think about the 2016 Republican primary. I was obviously running Carly Fiorina's campaign again, and like full disclosure to your listeners. And you had all these Republican candidates, none of whom wanted to take on Donald Trump, hoping A, that someone else would, and B, that it would fizzle out on its own. And the result was Donald Trump becomes the nominee. I think that these Republicans who think that, like, oh, this will all be over and he'll be relegated to the, ash heap of history after Biden's not inaugurated, are sort of missing the point that he still has this base of voters who now believe that the election was totally rigged. He has undermined institutions for these people in such a fundamental way that you saw what happened when Bill Barr said he didn't see any evidence of election fraud.
Yeah,
it's not that they then believed that there was an election fraud, is that they just thought Bill Barr was in on the conspiracy.
No, look at Fox News versus Newsmax. Same thing.
Right.
No, you're telling me something I don't want to hear.
Newsmax overtook Fox News in the 25 to 54 demographic for the first time. I mean, that is the only headline from this month, as far as I'm concerned.
I say it every chance I get. Newsmax was founded by a serial conspiracy theorist, Christopher Ruddy. It's shocking and astounding. Anyway,
a grifter or someone who believes it.
Yeah. Sarah Flores, always a pleasure to have you on and talk politics and just dork out a little bit. So thank you.
Thank you.
And I do. We started before since the recording's not over. I could say this. So before the recording, we were talking about does the political class need a fantasy football podcast? And you believe it does.
I absolutely, strongly, with all of my heart, need your advice on my fantasy team. I've made the playoffs. I'm the number 3 seed, so I don't get a bye. And I need your help.
If you ask Steve Hayes whether you really want my help, he will tell you how not so well I'm doing this year. The only person that thinks I'm a genius at fantasy football is my son right now, because I have given him advice 4 years in a row on which quarterback to take in like the 4th round. And in 4 straight years, it has been Carson Wentz, the year Carson Wentz was that guy.
Yeah, not this year.
He had Mahomes two years ago. He had Lamar last year, and he has Kyler Murray this year, though the Kyler thing is fizzling out. So he's lucky he's had Aaron Rodgers as a backup.
We had a nice run this year.
You had Dak, did you say?
Yeah.
It was an awesome first 3 weeks, wasn't it?
It really was. It was glorious.
Hey, if you're still listening, everybody, subscribe to The Dispatch. If you really want to make sure you're getting out of your silos and out of your comfort zones, Sarah and team do that very well. Anyway, thank you, Sarah. Have a good holiday.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Gilpin Green and Matt Rivera. John Reese is our executive producer, and our theme music is composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily on MSNBC every day at 1. Meet the Press reports on demand on Peacock or The Big Show every Sunday morning. So thanks for listening, and until we upload again.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
so many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.